loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, news today focused on the FBI's announcement that suspicious packages or device were sent to the homes of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, former DNC chairperson Deborah Wasserman Schultz, just days after a pipe bomb was sent to the home of George Soros, a billionaire donor for the Democratic Party. As political instability and polarization sweeps this country, we will take a look at how this fits a pattern of U.S. political life, drawing on the example of the 1960s and early 1970s, and looking at the role violence has played inside the United States since the inception of its history. And then it's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. This week, we'll start by focusing on the announcement that the U.S. government, the Trump administration, plans to leave the Intermediate Nuclear Range missile treaty with Russia.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, we continue our coverage of the midterm elections. Today, we'll take a look at Medicaid expansion, which is on the ballot in four red states. Next, the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs said yesterday that as many as 14 million Yemenis, half of the country's population, are at risk of starvation because of Saudi Arabia's war on that country. Mark Lowcock said, quote, "There is a clear and present danger of an imminent and great famine hitting Yemen that could be bigger than anything seen in the lifetime of any UN official." Then, Ecuador's foreign minister said yesterday that the country would no longer intervene with the UK government on behalf of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Jose Valencia departed from previous policy by saying that it is now up to Assange to deal with his own problems with the UK. And then Apple Corporation CEO Tim Cook launched a blistering attack yesterday in Brussels against what he called the data industrial complex. Cook said that the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation could provide an alternative model. And finally, last week we told you about an attack in southern Afghanistan against the governor, police chief, and intelligence director of Kandahar province. They were all killed when the governor's own bodyguards opened fire. The attack was claimed by the Taliban. But now we're learning that the primary target was U.S. Army General Scott Miller, the four-star officer in charge of all forces in Afghanistan. And U.S. Army Brigadier General Jeff Smiley was shot and wounded in the attack. And in other headlines, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal published last night, President Trump renewed his criticism of the Federal Reserve's handling of monetary policy. Trump said, quote, "Every time we do something great, he raises the interest rates," unquote, referring to Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. The Federal Reserve says it is raising interest rates from historic lows during the Great Recession to prevent inflation, but Trump has emphasized the threat this poses to growth rates. Mohammed Bishara, a 21-year-old Palestinian, died today after being seriously wounded by Israeli forces. Bisharat appears to have been shot in the chest during a protest in the West Bank. Major demonstrations have been taking place since the Great March of Return, although the actions have primarily been taking place in Gaza. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch attempted to downplay expectations of a new middle-class tax cut this year. The possibility of a tax cut has been floated by President Trump, but has been widely dismissed as a maneuver to boost Republican prospects in the midterm election. UN envoy to Syria Staffan de Mistura met with the country's foreign minister today to discuss efforts to ratify a new constitution. The United Nations has been pushing Syria to draw up a new constitution as part of a political settlement to the war. But Foreign Minister Walid Mo'alem said, following his meeting with de Mistura, quote, "The constitution and everything related to it is purely a matter of sovereignty that will be decided by the Syrian people itself without any foreign interference," unquote. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the news of the day. Explosive packages were sent to Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and former Democratic National Committee Chairwoman Deborah Wasserman Schultz, and to billionaire Democratic Party donor George Soros over the weekend. None of these explosive devices detonated, and no one was injured. Why are incidents like this so common in the United States? We are going to take a look at the issue of political polarization, factional struggle among political elites and their impact on the larger population, and the history and role violence has played during periods of political turmoil and indeed within the foundational structures of what became the United States of America. Later in this segment, we will be joined from Los Angeles by Dr. Gerald Horn. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. John Kiriakou, before we begin this discussion, later we're joined by Gerald Horn, who we talked to earlier today. I want to listen to a couple audio clips. One is from New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, and then comments that came just a little while ago from Donald Trump about the sending of explosive devices to the homes of political leaders here in the United States. Let's first listen to Mayor de Blasio.
What we saw here today was an effort to terrorize. This clearly is an act of terror attempting to undermine our free press and leaders of this country through acts of violence. I want to make very clear that the people of New York City will not be intimidated, that we are going to go about our lives undeterred.
John, that was de Blasio, Mayor de Blasio. He said this was an act of terror. These were bombs. These were pipe bombs. They did not detonate, but they were bombs.
Yes, the Secret Service has already said that these were live bombs. They were ready to go off. And it's not just the Clintons, Barack Obama, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and George Soros, as you said. Now they're telling us it's also Congresswoman Maxine Waters, and it's also Eric Holder. Now, for whatever reason, Eric Holder's bomb carried with it the return address of Debbie Wasserman Schultz's office. Maybe the would-be bomber thought he could get a twofer. But this is a very big deal. These were real live bombs meant to kill or to maim.
Yeah. And these are clearly against individual leaders who are associated with the Democratic Party. Certainly, Barack Obama was president. Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State and presidential contender against Donald Trump. Eric Holder was the Attorney General under Obama.
And one was also sent to former CIA Director John Brennan in care of CNN, which is kind of funny because John Brennan is a commentator on MSNBC, but it was sent to the wrong network.
So, John, and again, CNN, obviously, these bombs are targeting Democratic Party officials or media like CNN, which is associated with the Democratic Party or certainly anti-Trump media.
That's right.
Let's listen to Donald Trump's comments. They came just this afternoon. I think he's talking to us from the Oval Office. Let's listen.
I just want to tell you that in these times, we have to unify. We have to come together and send one very clear, strong, unmistakable message that acts or threats of political violence of any kind have no place in the United States of America.
Okay, John, that would be, I would say, somewhat expected. He's the president of the United States.
Right.
These are terrorist attacks against primary political leaders. Nonetheless, Donald Trump and the people who are supporting Donald Trump have been very vigorous in their denunciations of many of these same individuals. We're not, in this show, pro-Democratic Party, and we're not pro-Republican Party.
No.
We're not supporters, certainly, of Donald Trump, nor are we supporters of Hillary Clinton. We have been politically independent. We have been the voice of alternative media. So when we look at the story, we want to look at the story sort of in a big picture, not pointing fingers, not playing the blame game. A lot of that will happen nonetheless in the coming hours. And you know, given the fact that this is an extremely polarized political society right now, and we're on the eve of the midterm elections, we have the rise of the alt-right, so to speak. Many people who are Trump critics are saying that Trump has been sending dog whistles or even less obscured whistles to the ultra-right. He said after Charlottesville that and the killing in Charlottesville of Heather Heyer and the people coming to the Charlottesville rally with automatic weapons or semi-automatic weapons. He said there are very fine people on both sides. He's been advocating at his campaign rallies that protesters should be physically, forcibly thrown out. He said in the good old days, we would take them out on stretchers. Those are all things that happened.
Oh, yes.
And at the same time, the Democratic Party elites who are attacking Trump, I think usually for the wrong reason, are telling Trump or Trump supporters, look, the only reason Trump was elected is that he's the stooge, the Manchurian candidate of the Kremlin, something that's been completely unproved so far, but something that right-wing or conservative or Republican supporters will take to mean this is nothing more than a political ambush. So it's a society that is profoundly politically divided. When you hear Donald Trump's message, this is a time that we should all unify, it seems like a platitude. Yeah. It rings hollow.
It rings hollow because, look, you know, we've got a president who says outrageous things. Now, I think maybe in the back of his mind, he says a lot of those things to be cute or to rile people up. But there are consequences to some of the things that he says. There are a lot of crazy people out there. There are people who are going to take these insults to heart, and they're going to sit in their dank basements, and they're going to build bombs, and they're going to send them to Democratic Party luminaries and figures in the media. And that's what we've seen here. Mayor de Blasio was right, and Governor Cuomo was right today when they said this was a terrorist act. But this was a terrorist act that I think was spurred by the president's rhetoric. I mean, yes, it's ugly. Our political system is ugly right now. We're at each other's throats. We're really polarized. But he's going to have to take his share of the blame for this.
Well, it's unlike Donald Trump to take responsibility.
Completely.
Again, I would say that the political atmosphere, you know, we're going to play, John, for our audience, a clip with Dr. Gerald Horn to also go over why this is happening in the United States. Now, the United States has got a record, cultural, historical record, where there's lots of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that there's not political terrorism, especially associated with elections in other countries. In fact, that's a commonplace. So the United States is not exceptional in that sense. But there is a very long storied history in the United States where deep, profound polarization, in fact, has led to terrorist acts. It's led to political assassinations. It's led to mob violence. It's not something that's completely out of the blue or something completely separate and apart from earlier American political history. And you and I both come, because we're of a certain age, from a time period where political instability and violence were not exceptional, were in fact the norm.
Mm, that's right. That's right. As young as I am, I remember the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. You pointed out in a meeting that we had earlier today that the 1960s were rife with violence. It wasn't just the Kennedy brothers and Martin Luther King. It was Medgar Evers as well and Malcolm X as well. And so through that decade, political assassinations were not terribly unusual. That stretched into the 1970s. You know, George Wallace was shot in 1972 during the presidential campaign. Twice Gerald Ford was the victim of attempted assassinations.
Reagan was shot
in March 1981.
A couple months after he took office.
That's exactly right. I'd hate for us to slip back into that as the norm, but we really don't know in this era of heightened rhetoric how this is going to play out.
Yeah, and I think also what's missing here in this fierce antagonism, I think really factional fights amongst the elites that's kind of spilling over to the larger population more than anything. What's missing is independent voice, an independent political voice. There's a lot of angry people in the United States, and there's a lot of reasons and good reasons why they're angry. Income inequality is growing. Good jobs have gone overseas. For the black community, people are feeling occupied by police forces, targeted by racist caricaturing. Immigrant populations, Muslim populations also targeted. Women subjected to constant, ever-present violence from men. And we have a lot of division going on in society. What we need to do is have a way to address these political issues in a way that actually speaks to the masses of people, not motivated by a partisan political agenda, but that speaks to the actual needs of people. And these needs, these unspoken to issues, are issues that can be spoken to. These are not impossible to solve. They are possible to solve. They require human beings to intervene, to become players on the historical stage. and in fact to become the ones who are the dominant players in the historical stage, rather than the Democratic and Republican elites fighting it out and using the rest of the country simply as props.
Agreed.
And of course, John, there's this. This is going to be the beginning of an investigation. Nobody knows right now who did this. Nobody can make a credible claim to know that they know who did this. We'll have to wait and see. Again, though, it takes place in a very charged political environment. Now we're going to listen to Dr. Gerald Horn. We interviewed Dr. Horn earlier today when this news was just breaking about the delivery of explosive devices to the homes of other political leaders inside the United States. Now we are joined from Los Angeles by Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is a professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many, many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. Dr. Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for joining. Of course, the big news today, following up on the news that there was an explosive device, perhaps a pipe bomb sent to George Soros' home or in close proximity to it, was that the Obamas, the Clintons, and CNN also received suspicious packages. At the time that we're recording this segment, which is 11 a.m. Eastern time, we don't know the nature of it or whether there will be more news as the day evolves. But the reason we wanted to talk to you, Dr. Horn, is that we were having a discussion, even in our editorial meeting this morning here at Sputnik, and sort of reviewing why there is in the United States such a tendency towards violence, towards extremity, and what's going on today, including the profound sort of instability within the political system, even amongst elite factions. And then we were thinking back to the 1960s, and we had John F. Kennedy killed in November 1963, Robert F. Kennedy killed in 1968, thus changing the outcome of the next election, the 68 election. We had the killing of Medgar Evers, the killing of Malcolm X, the killing of Martin Luther King, the 1972 election impacted by the attempted assassination and debilitation paralysis of George Wallace, the white supremacist candidate from Alabama. You had Richard Nixon in 1974 having to step down rather than be impeached. In other words, there was this other period of American history that was marked by, I would say it stood out by, the profound instability and the application of violence as that decade, the 60s and the early 70s, unfolded. Just give us some historical context and your own views of what's happening today in comparison.
Well, it's striking that in the wake of the 2007-2008 crisis on Wall Street and in capitalism itself, Queen Elizabeth began to question the economists and wondering why they could not predict this particular result. I think that in light of the rise of Donald J. Trump and the political violence and the rhetoric of violence that has accompanied his ascendancy, we need to similarly query historians and those who call themselves political scientists about their inability, their lack of capability in explaining this present moment. If they were to be honest, they'd recognize that this nation was born in violence, not only in terms of an armed revolt against British rule, but then a constitution that in the Second Amendment sanctified the use of militias, not least to suppress Native Americans and to thwart slave uprisings. You mentioned the assassinations of the 1960s quite appropriately, but of course you could talk about the assassinations of the 1860s, not least that of Abraham Lincoln, killed by a right-wing white supremacist, speaking of John Wilkes Booth. And if you fast forward to today, you cannot help but notice the fact that the ultra-right has infiltrated the police departments of many urban areas, according to recent reports. Certainly, they've infiltrated the U.S. military. There's a certain impunity with regard to police killings and even with regard to civilians killing black people in particular. I'm thinking of George Zimmerman in Florida and the murder of Trayvon Martin. And then if you look at the larger architecture of violence, you also get very disturbing notes. Look at the rationalizations by Mr. Trump of the execution or presumed execution of the Saudi journalist, Mr. Jamal Khashoggi, and the fact that his comrades in the media, such as Rush Limbaugh, such as Fox News, are also fanning the flames of resentment and also fanning the flames of misinformation by helping to mislead their audience as to why this particular assassination took place, assuming that it did, which I do. I think that there's a fundamental disconnect in the GOP agenda. Obviously, what Mr. Trump is proudest about is tax cuts for the wealthy. But many in his base are not feeling the kinds of benefits that they think they deserve. And this leads to the politics of demonizing, the politics of resentment, blaming so-called Fox News, supposedly purveyed by CNN, blaming people like George Soros, for example, blaming leaders of the Democratic Party like Hillary Rodham Clinton and Barack Obama. And then that leads to the kind of violence that we're discussing at this very moment.
Dr. Horn, as you have helped us understand, this is not the first time where there's extreme instability in the country, extreme polarization in the country, and even the application of violence to settle political scores or to carry out a political agenda. Far from it. U.S. history is replete with it. But what do you believe is the driving force now, right now, in 2018, for this phenomena rearing its head at this moment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, look at the campaign slogan that Mr. Trump has unveiled in recent rallies, not least the one that took place in Montana. That is to say, caravans are looking at those thousands who are fleeing poverty and the depredations of U.S. imperialism in Central America and heading northward. Mr. Trump has suggested that there are so-called terrorists amongst them, not people seeking jobs, not people seeking a better life. And then, of course, he has raised the specter of Kavanaugh. That is to say, the raising of the question of racism with regard to Central America is then accompanied by the question of sexism regarding the alleged unfair treatment of now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who was credibly accused of sexual assault when he was a teenager in the Washington, D.C. area. But I have to keep returning to the larger architecture of violence. I recall that in the 1960s that our liberal friends used to say that violence does not settle anything, which of course ignored the question of how this country was seized from the Native Americans. It also ignored the question of the United States repeatedly seeking to use violence to accomplish political objectives, be it in Vietnam some decades ago, or be it in Afghanistan today, be it in Syria today, or even in terms of the attempted breakout of the nuclear agreement with Moscow, which obviously is designed to build up an arsenal by which China can be threatened. That is to say, seeking to accomplish political goals by means of violence or the threat of violence. And so it's little surprise when that kind of approach, quote, trickles down, unquote, to demented civilians who then begin to plant bombs at various places.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. Dr. Horn is talking to us today from Los Angeles. He normally talks to us from Houston, Texas. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. John, you know, what Dr. Horn is saying has a lot of there's so much to it, actually, in terms of the history of this country. And I want to just bring it back up to date. During the 2016 campaign, there was this big argument made by the alt-right that the Clintons, and again, we're critics of Clinton. We're not supporters of the Democratic Party.
That's right.
We're not supporters of Donald Trump or the Republican Party. But just making this point that the critics of Hillary Clinton were making the argument that the Clintons were running a pedophile ring.
Right.
Out of a pizza plaza, a pizza house.
Yes.
Somewhere close to where I live, a place that I've gone to where I've taken children to, where kids play ping pong. But the whole argument was in the back, this pedophile ring was taking place. And this guy came in. He was just a guy.
He drove up from North Carolina.
Yeah. And he started shooting the place up, starting shooting into the roof.
With an assault rifle.
To save the children.
And, you know, let me interrupt you for a second. Here we are 2 years later after that incident. And I still get at least one email a day from some total stranger wanting to know why we don't speak out against the elite pedophile rings on our show. I mean, this is it's become, God forbid, it's become almost mainstream.
Yeah. And then there's QAnon.
That's right, QAnon.
QAnon. Anyway, go ahead, Dr. Horn.
Well, it's striking that if you look once again at the history of the United States, you see very disturbing parallels. I'm thinking about the rise in the 1850s of the so-called Know Nothing Party, which is a precursor to the Ku Klux Klan arising in the 1860s. That is to say that the Know Nothing Party was heavily anti-Catholic. The Ku Klux Klan, as is well known, was heavily anti-Black. And one cannot understand the course of U.S. history without understanding this kind of political terrorism, this kind of right-wing political terrorism in particular. And I would also say that another cofactor in helping us to explain how we got to this point is the devastating attacks on left-wing labor in the United States, particularly during the Red Scare period and the Cold War period of the 1950s. I'm thinking particularly the West Coast Longshore Union under the leadership of Harry Bridges, who led the San Francisco General Strike of 1934. When left-wing labor was devastated, that meant that political education was also devastated. It also meant that wages and working conditions took a dive. And in that complexity of events, you begin to see how people can then adopt and accept demented explanations of why they're doing so badly, which leads us precisely to this moment we're discussing of the planting of political bombs against people like George Soros and presumably Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Another follow-up question. It seemed to me, I can remember Tommy Franks, who was in charge of CENTCOM in the Iraq invasion way back when, in 2003. He made the argument as he was retiring that if there was another terrorist attack or an even greater terrorist attack in the United States, he could envision the suspension of existing civil liberties and the imposition of martial law. Now, he was a top military leader, but given what happened after September 11th, where thousands, literally thousands of Muslims, people who are Arab or from South Asia, were rounded up, who were jailed, and in some cases jailed indefinitely, where mosques were the point of extreme surveillance, where people were being set up. Again, at that time, mostly limited to Muslims or to Arabs or to South Asians. Dr. Horn, can you envision, given the period of political instability and the application of violence, that this could also become pretextual for the limitation, at least, contraction of or suspension of existing civil liberties that most Americans take for granted?
I think it would be naive to rule out that kind of possibility. And let me point your listeners to what happened in Germany in the 1930s with the Reichstag fire, the attack on the German parliament, which presumably, and I would tend to agree, was perpetrated by Nazis and ultra-rightists, but was blamed on the left, which led to an acceleration and consolidation of power by the Nazis. This particular scenario, you may recall, is also raised in the recent documentary by Michael Moore, Fahrenheit 11/9. And I should also say it's been raised by Hollywood. Let your listeners screen, for example, the movie The Siege, starring Denzel Washington, which talks about how the allegation of so-called terrorist attempts leads to the mass incarceration of Arabs and Muslims, in particular in New York City. So therefore, we would be naive to dismiss the kinds of scenarios that you've just sketched.
We're going to leave it right there. We were joined from Los Angeles by Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is a professor of history at the University of Houston. He is a prolific author. I would say the most prolific historian in the United States, although I haven't done any big sample survey, Dr. Horn, but based on my own experience, it seems to me that you are, in fact, the most prolific. But more importantly than even the number of books, the quality of the books is such that people who actually want to understand American history as it was and not the fiction agreed upon, I encourage people to go wherever you do go. I don't want to send people to a particular online site, but look for Dr. Gerald Horn's books. One of his books includes Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment, Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States and around the world. We're joined from Des Moines, Iowa, by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and find out about the group by going to the website beyondnuclear.org. And we're joined in studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Roussel, who usually joins us at this time. But we have the addition of Walter Smolarek, another Sputnik news analyst and another producer of this show. Kevin Camps, Walter, Nicole, welcome.
Very happy to be here.
Kevin Camps, you are out. You are barnstorming, using your soapbox to spread the word, and you're also losing your voice. So as a compliment, we've added Walter, who, in spite of the fact that he's sick, is going to join us.
Anything for the show.
And Walter actually knows a lot about at least one of the big topics that we want to talk about, which is the announcement by the Trump administration to exit, to leave, to cancel, to abandon, to scrap the Intermediate Nuclear Range Treaty that was signed by Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan in 1985 in Reykjavik, Iceland. Again, we want to talk about, does this mean something big? Is it something not so big as the Trump administration is suggesting, that the treaty has become obsolescent and being violated by Russia? Anyway, Kevin Camps, when you heard the news, what'd you think?
Oh, it's awful. I mean, I think it was 87 in Reykjavik. I was in high school at the time and just learning about the dangers of nuclear weapons. And the good news back in 87 was, you know, this happened under Reagan, and Mikhail Gorbachev had actually proposed an entire abolition, a complete abolition of nuclear weapons by the year 2000. And unfortunately, Reagan stuck with his guns, literally, and insisted on having Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative, and the Soviet Union could not abide that. So we missed an opportunity for the complete abolition of nuclear weapons. But the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty that was signed between the two countries was a huge deal, because there was an uproar in Europe over, you know, being the target, essentially, having U.S. nuclear weapons on the ground in Europe, pointed at Russia, pointed at the Soviet Union, and in return, being pointed at by similar weapon systems in the Soviet Union. So it's a huge deal. It's a bedrock of nuclear weapons, arms control, and nonproliferation. And here is Trump yet again just ripping up an international agreement of the biggest significance you could think of.
Walter, this treaty, the reason I said 1985, it started actually based on an agreement in principle between Gorbachev and Reagan in 1985 in Reykjavik, Iceland. By the way, the U.S. Pentagon freaked out because in behind closed doors, Reagan agreed with Gorbachev that the world should get rid of nuclear weapons, so that all the alarm bells went off. Like, that's the last thing that should happen. We want nuclear weapons. Of course we do. Well, not we, but they. It started in 1985. Ultimately, this was a treaty between two nuclear powers, Russia and the United States, and it had to do with land-based intermediate-range tactical nuclear weapons. The argument made by the Trump administration is that it's no longer a world divided in terms of, you know, the menace of nuclear weapons, mainly between U.S. and Russia. It's now a multipolar world. The People's Republic of China was not a signatory. It's gone ahead and developed similar weapons, and the U.S. wants to constrain them. They're not constrained because they're not a signatory to the treaty. Also, the argument is made that while these are land-based missiles, the advances in technology for sea-based cruise missiles and air-based cruise missiles also makes this treaty not as prescient as it was in the mid-1980s. Anyway, is it, from a military point of view, significant? Or what do you think from a political point of view, what is its significance?
Yeah, well, I don't think that the INF treaty was ever designed to get rid of the threat of like world ending nuclear war. Right. I mean, there's because of, you know, what's called like the nuclear trident. Right. So land based intercontinental ballistic missiles, nuclear bombs that would be dropped from airplanes and submarine-based nuclear missiles. I mean, there's no way that there can be a nuclear war and human civilization sustains itself. But I think what the INF Treaty did that was important is that it restricted some of the most, like, quote-unquote, usable weapons. You know, the intermediate range, the more tactical nuclear weapons that would be more tempting to military planners to employ, thinking that, well, maybe it could be a limited nuclear exchange, one that doesn't obliterate all life on the planet. You know, it's scary stuff. And even though that's not, you know, nearly where the world needs to be, which is the abolition of nuclear weapons, it was, I think, an important guarantee. But I think politically what this means today, one interesting thing, an important thing, I think, is that it drives yet another wedge in between the United States and what were traditionally its junior partners in Western Europe. So among the people who denounced this move by the Trump administration, it wasn't just Russia that was upset. Germany was also very, very upset. And because they know that, you know, if an exchange of intermediate range nuclear forces means that Europe is sort of immediately vaporized.
Kevin Camps, this was in large measure about Europe, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were unprecedented anti-nuclear protests in Europe in response to, you know, being the bullseye between the U.S. and Soviet Union at the time. And what's really interesting from a personal perspective is that the Belgian organizers against these intermediate range nuclear weapons wanted the U.S. weapons out of their country. When they succeeded in that by 1991, when the treaty was carried out and enforced by both sides, then they were freed up to do something else. So you know what they did? They came to the United States and they organized the Walk Across America for Mother Earth with the Western Shoshone Indians. And a very young me, I think I was 22 at the time, joined that. And that was my great introduction to anti-nuclear activism. And, you know, meeting those Belgians, I met many hundreds of Belgians who were, you know, in the streets against these weapons and were talking about, you know, their parents, their grandparents living through World War One, World War Two. They suffered, you know, the German army coming through twice in essentially a generation. So they knew what war was about. And it was a real education for me.
I want to add, Brian, you know, we talked about this, the INF Treaty, when it happened on Monday in a longer segment. And since that's happened, there's been one update that's kind of interesting. So Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has essentially said that NATO is not going to deploy any more nuclear weapons to Europe if this treaty comes apart, which it obviously is since Trump is pulling out of it. It is my understanding there are already intermediate range nuclear missiles in Europe that the U.S. can use, but they are kind of coming out, like you said, against Trump and against the U.S. saying, you know, we are not going, NATO is not going to be moving any of these new missiles over to Europe.
Yeah, I mean, just, boy, it's an annual thing now in Germany itself and in other countries where, like Nicole said, there are still weapons that can be used. Sometimes they're jab fighter attached U.S. nuclear weapons that even the foreign pilots in these NATO allied countries could be the pilot of dropping the bomb. So anti-nuclear activists are infiltrating these bases on an annual basis and getting right up next to the weapons in these plowshares-like actions. So, you know, the fight goes on. And something that Walter said, I think that the treaties should be strengthened. They should be tightened. They should include other countries like China. They should include sea-based. They should include, you know, air-launched nuclear weaponry. That's really, you know, to protect our planet and our species. That's what we need to be busily doing. And that's why it's so heartbreaking when Trump and especially Bolton, I think a lot of this is because Bolton is in the position he's at National Security Council, tear up these very hard-won treaties that were not easily accomplished in the first place.
Yeah, and let's go back, if we might, to Bolton's role in the Bush administration, to the ripping up, the scrapping of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, another landmark treaty, perhaps even more significant than the INF treaty. That was back in 2002. I was re-looking at Vladimir Putin's speeches because I wanted to try to understand the evolution of Russian foreign policy in the last couple of years. And for the last couple of years, a hallmark of Putin's speeches was that the acrimony between the U.S. and Russia and the degeneration of international weapons agreements and nuclear arms agreements really began and was contextualized by the decision of the Bush administration. And I think Bolton was part of this decision to exit the ABM, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, back then. That was 16 years ago. Kevin, talk about the significance of that. Do you agree that that was sort of a threshold, crossing the Rubicon, so to speak?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier Ronald Reagan's insistence, and like you mentioned, the Pentagon was pressuring him and probably his inner circle of advisors to, you know, don't buckle under to Gorbachev. We need Star Wars. We need the Strategic Defense Initiative, the space-based missile protection system, anti-missile system. So, you know, fast forward to 2002, and now a new Republican president, George W. Bush, and his advisors like Bolton, they're still stuck on this idea of a missile defense system. We're going to shoot down incoming missiles. You know, and at the time, they were pointing to North Korea quite a bit, and they were saying to Russia, oh, this is not about you. This is about North Korea. This is about Iran. Well, the Russians were taking it very seriously. They knew that it would apply to their weapons, too, and it would take away the deterrent. And so, you know, I remember back to the Bush-Cheney years, there was a book that came out called Bush's Brain about Karl Rove. And the author, I don't even know that this is included in the book, but at the book talk, the author said that he had spoken to a U.S., a Democratic member of Congress who had gone to Moscow with Cheney when Cheney was still in Congress for arms control negotiations with their Soviet or Russian counterparts, depending on what year it was. And they were walking on Red Square afterwards. Cheney's role in the meeting had been essentially to scuttle any agreement, and he succeeded. There would be no agreement on this certain arms control category. And he asked Cheney what he was thinking about as they walked on Red Square. And Cheney said, I'm thinking about atomic bombs blowing up above Red Square. That's what Cheney was thinking about. So with people like that in positions like the vice presidency or Bolton at National Security Council, we're lucky to be alive, I guess is one way to put it.
Yeah, that's Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the Organization Beyond Nuclear. He joins us every Wednesday in this segment called Beyond Nuclear. You can read Kevin's work and learn about his organization by going to the website beyondnuclear.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek and Nicole Roussel. They are Sputnik News analysts and also the producers of this show, Loud and Clear. Let's go back, Walter, to think about arms treaties in general. Over the course of the last 100 years, there's been many agreements, some multilateral between multiple nations, some based on the United Nations covering almost every country in the world. Some are bilateral relations, bilateral agreements. In other words, there's been the idea that war could be managed or weapon systems could be managed, that they would be at some point either obsolescent or the other side's military advances were such that they nullified the advantage already ascertained by an earlier system. And thus the earlier advantage became null and void in essence. When the U.S. had a monopoly on nuclear weapons after the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima in 1945 and Nagasaki, the U.S. would have never signed an arms agreement with the Soviet Union, sort of giving up American nuclear weapons at a time when the Soviet Union didn't have nuclear weapons. It was only because of parity or near parity or a semi-parity between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and the ability of both sides to inflict maximum damage on each other that the possibility, the feasibility of nuclear arms agreements came into existence. So we had the 1963 Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the 1969 Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Then in the 1970s, there was the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, SALT I. Then SALT II, which was scuttled during the second part of the Carter administration. Then later, after the fall of the Soviet Union, START I and START II. In each and every instance, it wasn't simply the devotion or the new sort of allegiance to peace, but rather the sort of hard, cold reality that the old weapon systems didn't give one side unilateral advantage. Is that part of the reason this treaty is coming undone? Because there is the reality that China isn't a signatory, and China, according to John Bolton anyway, perhaps half of their missile technology, half of their arsenal would be classified as intermediate nuclear range missiles.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are two important principles that you identified there. I mean, one, the idea of deterrence. Yeah, I mean, once once, you know, the nuclear weapons are out there in the world, I mean, it's extremely, extremely difficult to get one side to disarm if they feel they have an advantage, if they think that their weapon systems are usable. I mean, maybe the most dangerous period of world politics was the late 1940s, where the United States had a nuclear monopoly. They were producing lots of nuclear bombs. They couldn't quite develop enough to launch a unilateral first strike on the Soviet Union. I mean, this was a big trend in politics. Like, why don't we just keep the war going? Why don't we keep the war going until the Soviet Union is overthrown? I think Winston Churchill said that his biggest regret was that, you know, he ended the war before his troops entered Moscow. And so, you know, there is the...
The man was truly a fiend.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he was a great diplomat.
Great hero. But yeah, no, of course not. I mean, he was, you know, an old school British imperial politician, and the United States actually had operational plans to carry out these first nuclear strikes on the Soviet Union. It was called things like Operation Unthinkable, Operation Scorch. There were many, many different, I forget the number, but it's like a lot, like more than 10 different like named operational plans to obliterate the Soviet Union, which would also obliterate China just as a matter of course.
And maybe, Kevin Camps, obliterate everything inadvertently. We've talked to Daniel Ellsberg and we've talked to you about Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine. But what Ellsberg, who at that time was a young man working for the RAND Corporation, what he found out working there, because he just with due diligence was trying to get answers to questions, was the Pentagon actually knew that the likely number of people to die in any sort of nuclear war, even in the 1950s, would be like in the range of 600 million as the beginning of the casualties. Talk about that.
Yeah, and Walter just mentioned it, that Ellsberg, in his book, The Doomsday Machine, revealed for the first time publicly that back in the day, back in the Eisenhower years when he began his work at RAND and then on into the Kennedy years, that the operational plans that Walter just mentioned for the U.S. attacking the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons just automatically included attacking China, too, just because they were communists. So that was pretty ghoulish, because that would add hundreds of millions of fatalities to that death toll you just mentioned. But something that they did not even understand at the highest levels back then was the concept of nuclear winter, which is now very well documented, that just 100 Nagasaki bombs exploding in a place, the case study was India, Pakistan, the burning cities would put so much soot up in the atmosphere, so thick, that within a very short period of time, it would block out the sun, and it would continue to block out the sun for year after year after year. And the end result would be 2 billion, with the B, 2 billion famine deaths from the exchange of 100 Nagasaki-sized bombs, which are relatively small. They're 15 kilotons. Modern nuclear weaponry is in the hundreds of kilotons, if, you know, and hydrogen bombs in the megaton range. So nuclear weapons on this tiny planet of ours are a disconnect. They don't go together.
Walter, I wanted to go back a little bit to the politics of this decision. I think early on, you know, when Trump initially announced he was going to leave the INF, it was mostly panned by media, but there have been, in the past couple of days, some increasing reports of people writing, you know, op-eds, writing editorials, being actually for this decision, which, you know, we've talked about the importance in the past, for sure, of this treaty. But I wanted to read to you and kind of get your take. This is an op-ed in the Washington Post from Elbridge Colby. He's the director of the defense program at the Center for a New American Security, which has really deep ties with the former Obama administration, and he served in the Obama administration. And it comes out for what Trump has done, so against the treaty. But the reasons he lists are really harken back a little bit to some of the treaties in the past that you were talking about. He says the reasons that we should, quote, no longer tolerate the INF status quo boil down to two. Russia appears unwilling to give up the systems that violate INF. And more important, the United States no longer benefits from a ban on ground-based intermediate range systems, but not because of China, or excuse me, because of China, not Russia. So he's essentially calling Russia out for being the bad guys here, even though we're the ones pulling out of it. And then he's also saying, well, it doesn't matter anyway, because, you know, we have all we need in Europe to be able to put Russia down. What we need to worry about is China. That's a really incredibly kind of hawkish position to be taking on this.
Yeah, yeah, that's remarkable. I mean, the Center for a New American Security is, you know, I think it was sort of considered to be like Hillary Clinton's State Department in waiting. It's remarkable for a couple reasons. And also, by the way, I mean, the name I don't think is a coincidence that it's so close to Project for a New American Century. which was sort of the core of the Bush administration military and foreign policy staff, people like Paul Wolfowitz, you know, the architects of the Iraq War. And it's the neoconservatives, right? It's the people who are like particularly aggressive about the use of military might to assert U.S. hegemony all around the world, maybe in their majority Democrats now and not Republicans. And it's a shift that's taken place over the last few years. Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think it's not surprising that some people in the media and in the think tank world came around to supporting Trump's decision, because, you know, the only time that Trump really gets applause from the media is when he does something like really bad. I mean, like bombing Syria was one of them, you know, and this was a measure that sort of puts to rest. I mean, not puts to rest, but, you know, is further evidence that the Trump administration is actually not pursuing a foreign policy that's favorable to Russia or Russian interests at all. It's actually, you know, it's profoundly hostile. So making moves like getting rid of the INF treaty, there's also all the sanctions that were imposed on Russia. And so I think this is, you know, something that makes them happy, because the Trump administration is basically falling for the trap, right, that, you know, they have to adopt an extra militant posture towards Russia to sort of head off these allegations that he's some sort of stooge.
And this is in contrast with one of the few decisions that Trump has made that we would actually support, which, right, is trying to create peace on the Korean Peninsula, right? These, you know, really important, you know, resoundingly important decisions that he and Moon and Kim have been talking about on the Korean Peninsula, something that we absolutely support here, that is an incredibly positive thing to be happening.
Yeah, the pivot to Asia policy, which is now sort of referenced as like, you know, the free and open Indo-Pacific, you know, it's all just a euphemism for the U.S. strategy to militarily and economically contain China. And if this gives them a freer range to deploy all sorts of advanced missile technology to the Pacific, that's something that I'm sure makes them happy.
Nicole, I'm glad you mentioned Korea. I'm looking at a website. I know nothing about this website, but I think the article is not atypical of a certain kind of thinking, especially in America. And in fact, it could only be in America. The headline says it all. Why the end of the Korean War is bad news for the United States, right? It has to be an American oriented. Nobody else in the world would think, oh, that's terrible. But here's what it says. And Kevin, I want to throw it back to you. To understand how the end of the Korean War might also mean the end of Korean dominance in Asia, here's a quick look at what the region wants out of a deal, country by country. Trump's problem is that he won't care about what other countries care about, as long as he gets his headlines. The rest of the deal doesn't matter, but the end of the war isn't written in the headline, it's in the fine print. Well, actually, guess what? The end of a war isn't written in the fine print. The end of a war is like when the bleeding stops, when the massive hemorrhaging, the massive, you know, use of public resources or potentially public resources for weapons ends. But then the writer goes country by country. And what the writer is basically saying, Kevin, is that absent the threat of another war like the war in 1950, a war which, by the way, for our listeners, ended when the North Koreans and Chinese signed an armistice agreement under the duress of being threatened with the absolute destruction of North Korea and the partial destruction of China by nuclear weapons, which was an explicit threat made by the Pentagon, adopted as a unanimous decision by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the spring of 1950. But what the article goes on to say is that if there's no threat of Korean War, then there's maybe less of a reason for U.S. troops to be in South Korea. There's less of a reason for all of these military bases that the U.S. maintains in Japan to be there. And as a consequence, neighbors could start to become neighbors. Neighbors could start to have their own independent and autonomous or semi-autonomous relationship, meaning China could be the neighbor of Russia and the neighbor of North Korea and the neighbor of South Korea and the neighbor of Japan. And guess what? The United States isn't actually part of that neighborhood. And thus, there's an incentive. And I don't think this is a small faction that actually thinks this. I think this is the dominant faction in American foreign policy establishment who, unlike Trump, and Trump seems to be sort of, you know, alone in this process, actually thinks the change of the status quo, which is technically the country still at war, is a bad thing, not a good thing.
Well, I mentioned it earlier in the context of the Belgian anti-nuclear activists who I learned so much from, their parents and grandparents living through two world wars in a lifetime. And it's a common pattern for me. The most I learn about anti-war values, anti-nuclear values, often comes from survivors of these horrors. So the Hibakusha of Japan, the survivors of the atomic bombings, are the check against the moves by the current Prime Minister, Abe, to remilitarize Japan, to get more involved in international conflicts. You know, this return to a militaristic Japan that China and Korea, don't like, to put it mildly. You know, I was at a war show in the United States, an air show, they call it, but it's showing off warplanes. And we were doing a protest at the front entrance, and, you know, the response from some people was pretty hostile and belligerent against us for being there doing that. But one of the women I was standing with was a German survivor of World War II, and she said something along the lines of, the only way you could enjoy this, you know, reenactment of a bombing run that they were doing is if you've never been under the bombs. You know, ending a war is a very good thing. And you were talking about the hemorrhaging of money, Brian, but, you know, in the first hours of a Korean conflict today, there would be hundreds of thousands of deaths. And in the first days, there would be millions of deaths, because the North Korean military has Seoul in its sights, something like 2,000 howitzers. So even if a nuclear weapon isn't used, there would be millions of deaths in the first days of a full-on conflict.
Kevin Camps is our guest. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear, and we do this segment Beyond Nuclear every Wednesday. I'm Nicole Roussel. I'm one of the Loud and Clear producers, and we're also joined by Walter Smolarek, a Sputnik News analyst and Loud and Clear producer. Kevin, we've just got about 4 minutes left, but there's two things we definitely want to get to. First of all, great news. Trump says that he's against the yucca dump. What do you think about it?
We'll see how long it lasts. Dean Heller, the Republican incumbent U.S. Senator from Nevada, is the most vulnerable on the Republican side up for re-election. So Trump goes out to Elko, Western Nevada, and guess what? He's completely flip-flopped on his pro-yucca dump position to try to rescue Dean Heller's candidacy. You know, it was really ironic that same weekend, last weekend, that Trump, on short notice, goes out to Elko to stump for Heller and reverse himself on a major policy decision.
That explains it.
The Western Shoshone Indians were having a cultural gathering out there at the same time, and Yucca Mountain is their land.
Mm. Didn't you also, I sent you this article earlier in the week, and you were rightfully pretty angry about it. Hasn't he also already funded, in past budgets, already funded Yucca Mountain? So this is like very, very clearly a complete flip-flop.
Yeah, the Trump administration has requested large increases in Yucca dump funding to restart the Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensing proceeding, but they haven't gotten it because there's so much logjam on Capitol Hill, which is a good thing. But it's because the House Republicans want the Yucca dump. Yes, they do. They would approve that budget request from Trump. But the Senate, on a bipartisan basis, unfortunately, is more into centralized interim storage. And that impasse has led to no funding for either idea. And that's gone on for like 8 years. So, yeah, it's just saying, because last year, Rick Perry, the energy secretary, at a House budget hearing, said, why don't we just do interim storage at Yucca? And the response from Nevada was so intense that he had to backpedal immediately. So you can tell where they're coming from. They just want their dumps. They don't care where they go. They'll settle for whatever they can get. And so Trump's words are, you know, I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah, absolutely. Kevin Camps, you're out in Des Moines, Iowa right now, and you've been doing an Iowa speaking tour.
Which we could tell because your voice is almost gone.
It's almost gone.
That's how I blew it out. I did three talks in the last 2 days, Davenport, Iowa, Iowa City, and Des Moines. And it was all about high-level radioactive waste transportation risks bound for places like Yucca Mountain, Nevada, or Waste Control Specialist, Texas, or Holtec, New Mexico. Any one of these western dumps opens, and Iowa is going to see something like 5,000 shipments of high-level radioactive waste come through over the course of 25 years or 50 years. So you can start to do the math, you know, 5,000 shipments divided by 50 years shows how routine Iowans would see these things coming through.
Yeah, we've talked about some of the dangers of moving. I mean, it's literal radioactive waste. We've talked about the dangers of moving that around. I'm glad you're out there doing the speaking tour.
I'm going to save Kevin Camps in the last 30 seconds of this show and not force him to speak again. But I want to just remind our audience that the reason we do this segment is that there's not enough attention in the mainstream media, the corporate-owned media, about the issues of nuclear power, the issues of nuclear weapons. Radioactive Waste Watchdog Kevin Camps is an expert, and his organization, BeyondNuclear.org, does amazing work. They don't just sit here in their home offices in Washington, D.C. Kevin is in New Mexico, he's in Des Moines, he's in Michigan. He and other activists are going out all over the country building really what is, this is a David and Goliath movement. It's a grassroots movement. And I want to encourage our listeners to go to their website, learn about them, show your support for Beyond Nuclear, and keep listening to this segment, which comes to you every Wednesday on Loud and Clear.
It is a David and Goliath movement, but I want to add that they win. I mean, they definitely win when they get the public involved.
Well, didn't David win?
Oh, right.
All right. We're joined from Des Moines, Iowa by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the Radioactive Waste Watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. And we were joined in studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Roussel and Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.